Well, hey, everybody. Welcome again to CPC Together. Today's a very special episode. I'm very, very excited because, well, what you're about to listen
to...
That
was two verys. That's how excited you are.
Yeah. I could add a third. But
I'd add a third, too. Very, very, very excited.
What you're about to listen to is a conversation with Ruth Haley Barton. And if you're following along with us at all, you know that we're going to be going through her book with our practice labs. And she wrote Invitation to Silence and Solitude. And just a little bit about Ruth. She spent 20 years as a student, a practitioner, and a leader in the area of Christian spirituality and spiritual formation, which is convenient because that's what we're doing right now. She served on the staff.
Almost like we knew which expert to call. Like, she's the one. Let's call her.
She served on the staff of several churches before founding the Transformation Center. And that's a ministry dedicated to creating space for God to strengthen the souls of leaders, equipping them to lead transforming communities. Her voice is courageous, authentic, unique. I would say that all of that rings true with the conversation you're about to hear. She's bold in tackling the issues of the day while always inviting us into deep spiritual practices mm-hmm. that draw us near to God. So, guys, settle in. This is going to be an amazing conversation. And while we're talking about, before we go into it, we are talking about practice labs. When is that coming up and how do people get involved with this?
Yeah, practice labs are coming up. It's 4 weeks starting on October 30th from 1:30 to 3. And we're going to tackle some of these questions of what to do in silence and solitude. How do we focus our attention on God? What do we do when distractions arise? And you can expect to have a mixture of both practical tools to help us in those times with him, as well as just a time to experience silence and solitude together in community. And if that interests you, you can register at cpc.org/events. And if you're listening on the app right now, you can even go to the events tile and register there as well.
Yeah, and I really encourage you guys to sign up for these. It's again, trying to take the kind of the sermon, the ideas, the vision, everything we're kind of putting out and saying, how do we actually do this on the ground? Like, how do we integrate this into our daily life? And so that's our heartbeat behind these labs, is to get you into a space where we can lead you into those experiences to give you a taste of it, and then hopefully have some good dialogue, overcoming obstacles, challenges, as well as then having dialogue around, okay, how do we integrate this into our life, and how do we make this go beyond just a Sunday sermon and a small group curriculum or whatnot, and try to push kind of deeper into our lives. So anyway, I encourage you to check that out, and this it's a good conversation we have with Dr. Barton.
And one of the things she says that we want to just pass on is, you know, we can't underestimate how hard this is at first. This is a difficult journey. And the more we can lean into starting this journey together, the more chance we have for it to stick. So with all of that, Ruth Haley Barton. You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area. We're so excited to be here with you, and we're going to just jump in if you're okay with that. We want to.
Yep.
So we are so excited to be here with you. I just want to introduce so you know who you're here with. I don't know if you expected us to all be in here.
I didn't, but that's okay. It'll be good energy, right? It's going to be good energy.
So I'm Brandon Passion. I'm the worship pastor here at our church, and I help kind of produce these podcasts. Here in the Patagonia, I don't know right or left how to do this, but that's our lead pastor, Kevin Sneed.
Hi, Ruth. Good to see you.
Rachel, if you can wave Rachel. Rachel's the one that was kind of connecting with your team, and she's helping kind of coordinate a lot of this vision stuff that you're helping us get through right today. And Liz is, she basically should be on staff because she's like an amazing volunteer. She's a huge Ruth Haley Barton fan, and we had to have her here because she just has so much that she wants to talk to you about. So we're really, really excited to be here with you. So thank you for taking some time with us. So Kevin, I wanted to real quick explain to Ruth what's going on with our vision and what we're doing with the silence and solitude and why we want her involved and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to first start by just saying, I know you have a Doctor of Divinity, and I am an academic in a PhD program, and there's something in me that says I have to call you Dr. Barton.
Oh, yeah, please I have don't. Not,
I know that, but if it slips out, know that that's
okay.
Why. Like,
okay, but all
because
right.
Because I have not like, earned that there? Title. Yeah, I have not earned it yet, so it's like I got to keep it aspirational. So
Dr. Barton or Ruth, so good to have you here. You know, one of the things we're doing this fall with our church is really re-architecting our church around a shared rule of life and kind of moving from, we have a rich history of expository preaching and that's been a really, really good, strong foundation that we want to build from into a more embodied formation. And so in that, we're moving and really centering our rule of life around two goals for an apprentice of Jesus, which I'm a huge Willard fan, so I'm just robbing anything smart I say is probably from him. But we're kind of basing this rule of life off two goals, presence with Jesus and participation with Jesus. And so out of that comes different habits and practices that we're developing out of those things. And where we're starting is with this practice of attentiveness, where we just say, if we are going to follow Jesus faithfully in this day, particularly in our area of the Bay Area and how fast-paced it is and how much distraction just invades our soul at every moment. This first habit we have to cultivate is the practice of silence and solitude, just as a way of slowing down. And so I know in the preface of your book, Invitation to Silence and Solitude, you talk about how you were drawn into this this practice of silence and solitude, really out of, I think in some ways, a similar story of where our church is, where it's busy, fast-paced, go, go, go. And yet it was that kind of push into that you talk about, that push pull phenomenon, which is great as well, but it's, you found yourself at a moment where you had to step into it. And I think in some sense, that's where our church is at as well. So I'd love to hear if you don't mind just sharing a little bit of like, how did that transition where you were kind of, again, in that moment of despair, needing to go into silence and solitude, what was that part of your journey like? And then kind of with an eye on us as a church starting that journey, like what would you offer and maybe how those two journeys either parallel or what you've learned since then?
Yeah. Well, wow, that's a big one and two type of question. So I'm going to just go with number one. And if you want to reiterate number two, you know, based on what I say, then go ahead and bring out some of those other threads. But well, I sometimes joke about the fact that I'm an overachiever in every way, including the fact that I burned out in my early 30s. I didn't wait till I was 45 or 48 or 50. I burned out in my early 30s. So I hate admitting that, but that is the truth. And I'm a pastor's kid. And so, you know, burned out doing really, you know, godly things that seem to be really good. And I started ministry right out of college, actually in college. And then so by the time I reached my early 30s, I'd been in ministry for 10 years and I was married with three kids and began to recognize the fact that there were still some questions that I didn't have any answers for. There was emotions that I couldn't manage, some anger, some sadness. And definitely a sense of self-centeredness. And I was like, wow, I've been a Christian since I was 4 years old, but I'm not changing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the profound admission, was that I just wasn't changing, even though I'd been in church all my life, like literally born into the church and had been in church all my life. And so at that point, I really felt like I needed to find something more in my own spiritual life. And so I dropped out of church at that time, dropped out of life in ministry because I was in ministry at the time. Mm-hmm. And I did that in a really intentional way to seek more of God than I had at that time. And because I was a pastor's kid, I needed to separate out some threads in my life. So I needed to separate out God from my dad, from the church, you know, from my own identity, even, you know, the fact that I had created and crafted an identity around being a person in ministry. And so, and being a good Christian, like being a really good, faithful Christian. And so I had the help of a really good spiritual director and she was a therapist as well. And I thought, well, we're going to start having these meetings and she's going to listen to me. I'm going to talk a lot and she's going to fix me up psychologically and send me back out, you know, to be a good, healthy person. So we did some of that work. It was really, really valuable. But then at some point she looked at me and she said, you know, Ruth, you're like a jar of river water all shaken up. Mm-hmm. And what you need is to sit still long enough for the sediment to settle and the water to become clear. And I hadn't ever had anyone invite me into solitude and silence. This was, you know, 20 years ago now at least. And at the time, I would have thought, well, she's, you know, talking about becoming a Buddhist or some new age philosophy. And but I was desperate. And so it didn't in some ways matter to me at that point. I just wanted something to change. And so I began to practice solitude and silence at her invitation and her instruction and with her guidance. And it was very, very different for me. I was used to filling up my quiet times with Bible studies and systematic prayers and, you know, Christian self-help books were all the rage back then. So you get your Cloud and Townsend and you, you know, get to work on yourself. And so my quiet time was anything but quiet. I will say it was still full of a lot of human effort. And so this invitation to solitude and silence was a very different kind of invitation. And it was really hard. She gave me this remedial work of trying to sit in solitude and silence for 10 minutes a day. And I thought, oh, that's easy. I can do that. Well, I couldn't. I mean, at 5 minutes, I'm like, wow, the clothes need to be moved from the washer to the dryer. The lawn is growing really fast outside the window. I would always get my best article ideas. So I'd want to get up and go to my computer and write to an editor of some sort. And I would go back to my spiritual director and I'd say, oh, this is so hard. I'm not doing very well. And she would say, well, this is what it's like. You know, you've been living at this pace. You've been, you know, running fast for so long. This is what it's like. And she said, you know, now you know something about yourself you didn't know before. You know that you're full of chaos on the inside. I would have liked to have thought that I had the peace that passes understanding, but the truth is that I was chaos on the inside. And now I could name that more honestly. And so the idea that Richard Rohr puts forward, that a good journey begins with knowing where you are and being willing to go someplace else. That was what that image held for me, that I was now finally naming where I was a little bit more honestly. I am the jar of river water all shaken up. I'm not this idealized view of myself that I thought I was. And the jar of river water also held the vision and the image of what I wanted for myself. And that was to have sat still long enough so that I could see clearly and so that I could know God's love for me in an experiential way. And so I wouldn't be so chaotic on the inside. So it was both. It was the self naming at right there and naming where I was, but also saying, and that's where I want to go. And, you know, I'd been a Christian for such a long time that the biblical language for these things was a little bit dead to me, you know? And so it was even having fresh language and a fresh image that helped me to name and to be in touch with who I was and where I was, but also where I wanted to go. And that was the beginning for me. And I entered in, but with support. I'm really grateful that I had her support, because then I continued to work on it and continued to try. And it took me probably about a year for the sediment to settle and the water to become clear. And I mention that to people because I hope it's an encouragement. Yeah. That whatever we're experiencing in the early parts of our journey into solitude and silence, it's pretty normal. And that this is not a quick fix discipline. Solitude and silence is not the quick fix. It is a long obedience in the same direction.
Yeah.
And then we begin to see the results eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. A year to settle. I'm really glad you said that, because I think there is that we have that quick fix mentality, right? And how would you, in that year, like, what did you feel 6 months in? You know what I mean? Like, what held you to that practice? Because most of us are just not committed to do something like that for a year to really see kind of the sediment. Was there a gradual growth where that sediment was settling? Or, I don't know, just talk about what held you to that practice for a year.
Yeah, it's definitely subtle and imperceptible. So, you know, you're not going to perceive it. In fact, one of the things that I tell people now and that I know now is that oftentimes you're not even going to perceive or experience the benefits within the 10 minutes or whatever it is that you've committed to. You're going to perceive the benefits out in your life with other people. But you're probably going to continue to only experience the chaos, at least in the early stages. And so a couple of things. One was my desperation. I mean, nothing else I had tried had worked. And so where else was I going to go? You know, I was desperate, and I had a really good spiritual director who believed that this is what I needed. And so it was my own desperation with the confidence that she was expressing that this was what I needed. This would bring about what I was looking for, and having a place to process what I was going through. I think if I had been completely alone at that time without a guide, I would have probably given up. And so when I wrote the book, Invitation to Solitude and Silence, you know, it's not like there's not great books on solitude and silence out there. I mean, you know, Thomas Merton wrote about it, Henry Nouwen. So as an author, you have to find your voice. You have to say, okay, so what am I bringing to this topic that other people have written so beautifully and profoundly about? And I landed on the role of the spiritual director, and I am a trained spiritual director. And so by the time I wrote this book, I had done my training and I was, you know, working as a spiritual director, and I landed on, I want to be the person that says, let me take you by the hand and walk you in, like my own spiritual director had done for me. And the person who says, let me help you make sense of that experience that you had in solitude and silence. So that was definitely the voice. That was definitely what I decided I landed on trying to accomplish, was to be the spiritual director type person who says, let me take you by the hand. Let's walk into this together. And when you're floundering and, you know, afraid that you're not even on the path, let me be somebody who can help you, you know, to know what's happening right now and to help you to stay true.
Yeah. That's so good. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. I just have to say, I so appreciate the way you write, the way you were saying that you found your voice. I feel like comes clearly through this book, your voice. I felt like I knew you as I was reading, and that was really helpful. Just a little bit about me. I just happened to come across your book like 4 years ago at a retreat that really felt like not a retreat. It was very busy and noisy, and I
do hate it when that happens. Yeah. When I think I'm going to a retreat and it ends up being very busy and noisy and loud.
Yeah, I know. And that's how I felt. So I didn't really know what to do with it, but I was in this little bookstore and I came across your book, and the title was so inviting. I mean, it's literally Invitation to Solitude and Silence. And I, you know, I feel like I've heard some of your podcasts before where you talk about you like movies. And it made me think of Jerry Maguire, where that line where he's trying to get his wife back and she's just like stopping him. She's like, you had me at hello. And that's the way I felt with your book. It was literally like two pages in. I was like, you're writing exactly what I need. And so I just had a question about kind of right at the beginning. It was actually the way Dallas Willard was saying at the beginning in the foreword about how we've been had by a system of behavior that was here before we were and seeps into every pore of our being, and that we have to choose these practices that break us out of this system. And so my question is that I felt that. I felt that desperation to break out of the 100-mile-an-hour pace that I've been living in as a Christian, doing great things, like you were saying. But yet I really resonated with the fact that you spent a lot of time writing about that this is an invitation. It's not something that God is forcing on me, but he's inviting me into. And I thought that was a really beautiful way to write about it. I thought maybe, how would you kind of distinguish between how Willard is saying it's something you must do, and I agree with that, but also it's an invitation?
Yeah. Well, I think an invitation I use that word really, really, really intentionally. I love the word invitation, and I use it in other ways as well, because I think an invitation means that you actually have a choice. And that's really, really important, is that we know that we do have a choice. And yes, I will say, I believe solitude and silence is absolutely essential to a life, you know, to a spiritual life. You know, Nouwen says that without solitude and silence, it's impossible to have a spiritual life. And I believe that. And I agree with that, because, you know, solitude is the place where we stop the flow of our own words and actually listen to God. And solitude always starts with God, God's invitation to us. There's, even the fact that we're feeling invited is an indication that God's already within, that God's already at work, which is deeply encouraging. If you're having that sense of, you know, being invited, then God's already at work. God's already there. He's preceding the invitation itself, you know, as you're understanding it. So to have a choice is really important, for some of us more than others, but to know that we're not being forced is really important, while at the same time also affirming that solitude and silence are essential practices for a truly spiritual life. The other thing about invitation that I love is that it indicates that I am wanted, you know, that when I get invited by somebody, it means they want me. And I think we all long for that feeling, you know, that somebody wants me. And in this case, it's that we're wanted by this very special person called God, you know, that God is inviting me because God wants to be with me in a particular way, that God is saying, you know, I love being with you in your life. And I'm no more present in solitude than I am in your normal life. But I like this other way of being with you. You know, it's like a married couple, you know, you love doing your life together and it's really, really fun. But there comes a moment where you say, we need some time. You know, we need to turn instead of facing the world, you know, together, we need to turn towards each other and give each other our full and undivided attention. And it's not that God's any more present, but it's that we're giving each other our full and undivided attention. I'm giving God my full and undivided attention. I'm inviting God to be present with me in some different ways. I'm giving God a more full and complete access to my soul. That's what the opportunity is there. And God is saying, I love being with you in the hullabaloo of your ordinary life, but man, I would really like to get some really good time with you. That's really what the invitation is. And to be invited like that, to know that God wants me in this particular way is really beautiful, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't remember if it was, in your book or elsewhere, but I've heard that metaphor of kind of, particularly science and solitude functioning and really any of the disciplines functioning in the similar manner of like, a date night or something with your spouse, right? Like it's a structure in place that helps you, bump into that intimacy, but yet often there are times where, it doesn't feel like we get to just willfully step in, or sometimes it's work, other times it's great. Like there's that dynamic that's at play there. And I think there's a hesitancy. I know, as I've talked about some of these things with other people, and even in my own kind of soul of that, how do we deal with it when it's it feels like a rigid structure, and it gets back to maybe even a little bit of that, like patience in community of saying, I've got to commit to this over time and allow God to slowly do that. I think it's in chapter 2, you bring out that, or it might be chapter 3, that push pull phenomenon, of how we all feel the push towards it. Like, and just to stretch the metaphor of date night, right? Like we all know date night's an important thing with our spouse or that time. But yet sometimes it's like the week's so crazy, it'd be better if we didn't, or we feel that. And so then we kind of retract and pull away from that. I don't know if there is just advice you'd give to someone who's sensing that push-pull. I think that's, it's been profoundly true for me, where I know these certain disciplines I should step into and embrace, but yet I retract from it. So I don't know if you'd have encouragement for one that's feeling that kind of push-pull phenomenon, or how you'd kind of speak into that.
Well, first of all, let's distinguish between the push-pull phenomenon and someone who's just not ready. Knowing that you guys are trying to roll this out at a congregational level, I think it's really important to identify that there is a certain kind of readiness for solitude and silence. And it's an invitation that for some comes a little bit later on in the journey. And so we don't want to encourage people, if what they're doing is not broken, don't make them fix it. That if some of the other ways of being with God are actually working for them, through Bible studies and the more structured prayer life and things like that, you don't want to take them out of what's really working for them, because that's an early part of the developmental stage. And there's every possibility that solitude and silence could become another ought and should if they're not ready. And if they're not feeling the sense of invitation that some of you are naming that you've experienced. So I just want to caution you a little bit that there's a little bit of difference between push-pull and actually not being ready.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, that's really good.
But the push-pull phenomenon is different than that, in that it's a true indicator that God is up to something. When we feel the push-pull, to me, that's always something that I pay attention to in myself, and when I'm in spiritual direction with others, is that it's probably an indicator that God really is up to something when we feel that sort of mixed feeling. And so the encouragement there then is to press through the resistance and go ahead and enter in if you're feeling both the push-pull.
Yeah.
And to not as an ought and a should, but you got to stay in touch with the deepest part of your desires. So let's go back to the example of the husband and the wife. If you're feeling the push-pull, then, you know, you want to press through. And it's not so much about should as much as it's about touching the deepest desire of your heart, which is to have a real relationship with this person and to keep doing the things that help you to cultivate a real relationship. So you want to drop down to the deepest desire that you have in this relationship and towards this person. You're not going to press through because of ought and should. You're going to press through because you know it's going to be good for your relationship if you go ahead and push through. And that's really different than oughts and shoulds. And so, especially because you're going to be trying to bring this at a congregational level, I'm going to nuance some things for you pretty carefully, because I would never want something as beautiful and gorgeous as solitude and silence to feel imposed or like you have to do this to be spiritual, have to do this to be with us.
I think I think it's Rollheiser talks about that deepest, strongest desire. And that's been really helpful to think through. And I love the way you're framing that, even for our congregation to recognize, like, it's got to come from desire. It can't come, it can't be coerced. It can't be imposed. It has to come from desire. I just think that's, that's really helpful. So thank you for sharing that.
If you need any, I don't know if you've interacted with Sacred Rhythms, but the first chapter of Sacred Rhythms is on desire. And so I think that's where it all needs to start. And of course, in Invitation to Solitude and Silence, I talk about desire that deepens into desperation.
Yes.
So either way you go at it, it's there. It's got to be the starting point.
Ruth, there's a quote that you quote Henry Nouwen, where he says, without solitude, it's virtually impossible to live a spiritual life, which, you know, it's a very strong statement. And I don't know, I can think of a handful of people, and maybe me sometimes, who would be like, is that really true? What'd you say? I know you don't want people to feel forced into this, but how would you respond to that?
It is a very, very strong statement. But the more I think about it, the more I believe it's true, because if solitude is the place, a solitude coupled with silence, by the way, where we stop the flow of our own words and our own thoughts and our own activities and our own initiations and our own agenda, and we let God be God in our lives, and we listen for the still small voice of God, the spiritual life begins with the voice of God. You know, the spiritual life is not something we initiate. The spiritual life begins with God. Anything that is truly spiritual begins with God. Even this whole aspect of desire and love, you know, we love him because he first loved us. We reach for God because he first reached for us. There's nothing in the spiritual life that originates with us. It all originates with God.
Amen.
So solitude and silence is a place where we create the space for God to be the prime mover in our lives, for the still small voice of God to be heard, for the spiritual life to emerge from God's initiations, you know, in our lives. So it's as extreme as it seems. I do think it's true. I think a lot of other things can go on without solitude and silence. But a truly spiritual life, I don't think that can really go on without some time and space where we give God our full and undivided attention and let God be the initiator and the prime mover in our lives, and actually initiate our spiritual lives, you know?
Where do you think that impulse comes from? Because I agree that I think our default setting is that it begins with us. Right?
Yes, and it is. Even our desires, we think, oh, I have this desire within me. And, you know, and I want to say, well, even the fact that you have a desire for God shows that God is already there and alive and active.
Wow. So where do you think we buy that myth? Like, where is that just kind of a Western individualism, like the fruit of that? Or like, where did we lose the plot there? Because I agree, but I think we just kind of think of it that way, right? As the kind of the natural disposition. Like, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. I'm just interested on that.
I do think it's Western. I do think it's very, very Western, very individualistic. And also this, you know, the rugged individualist who gets it all done for him or herself. You know, like whatever most needs to be, I'm going to be my own. I'm going to pull myself up by my own bootstraps and get it done. And I think that's why a truly spiritual life is so challenging, is because the truest parts of the spiritual life come at God's initiation. And they unfold in God's way, in God's time. And we really don't have much control over it, but that's a very hard and uncomfortable place for us to be. And this is also why it's partly where we are on the journey as well. I mean, developmentally, if you just think about the development of the personality of the human person, part of what happens in our younger years is that we do develop a sense of agency. We do develop some ego strength. We do develop some skills and competencies. We do try to take some control over our own lives and set our own destinies. And it's not really until the second half of the journey that we're even ready to let somebody else besides ourselves be in control, or to press through the myth that we are in control, which is not actually ever very true. But, you know, they're developmentally, there is a need to develop some of those, you know, some of those ways and ideas, the ego strength, so that we're not a, not a noodle, you know? That's how we accomplish what we accomplish in the early parts of our lives. And that's why the second half of life and the transition into the second half of life are so challenging, because it challenges us at this very, very level.
Yeah. I just can't help but think, I've got a new middle schooler this year, and I'm thinking of that transition as a parent, and how there certainly was a perceived control I had when she was younger. Although, to your point,
absolutely,
I didn't really. She's a human, right, and has her own agency. But it's been interesting, as you were just talking there, thinking how, as I've tried to adapt and had to adapt, my wife has done much better than I have at this. But as I've released control to let her be her, it's allowed us to grow in intimacy. And there's been a deepening where I can let her be her unique self in this particular stage. With all of the complexities and nuances and awkwardness of middle school, but yet it's allowed that like deepening and enriching of our relationship. And so it makes sense, right? That if we map that onto our the spiritual life, of course there's, as we release that and allow God to meet us where we are, there's a depth there. But.
You know, just acknowledging the diversity of the body of believers, one question I had was just, with silence and solitude, what might this journey look like across different life stages? Like, I think of even someone who might be on call, like parents or caretakers, people with really demanding work life.
Well, I like to remind people, and maybe you can remind your people about this, that I wrote this book in my early 30s. And God's invitation to me to solitude and silence came in my early 30s when I, well, wait a second, I didn't write the book in my early 30s. I experienced this journey in my early 30s, the beginnings of it. And that God's invitation to me came when I had a 7-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a newborn baby, and I was nursing. So I was wanting to say to God, are you really kidding me? Could you have done this at a different time in my life? This is really hard, you know, but I want to say that, because it's easy to look at me now and to say, well, she's got an empty nest and she can do all this. Well, that's not when it happened. It happened for me when I was a young mother and a young wife, and really making some risky choices in my life, for my own spirituality. So, yes, there will be particular challenges at different life stages, and particular challenges having to do with personality types as well. But I, what I learned during those years was that God can take whatever offering we make in terms of time. So for me, it really was just the 10 minutes back then. That's all I really could get. And God could take the 10 minutes and make it enough. And so I had to trust that God was still the God, like, who increased the 5 loaves and 2 fishes and made it enough for to feed the people, you know, that God can do that with time as well. And that whatever time we have to offer, if we're intentional about it and we're offering it for this purpose, you know, God is anxious to meet us. God is waiting to meet us in whatever quiet spaces we can create, and is very generous in that way. So whatever we can find, I think God will come into that space and make it enough. The other thing that's just really true about the younger parenting years is that we do need to work with the people in our lives. So, you know, if I hadn't had a husband who was able to acknowledge God's call in my life at that time and help me get some solitude times, get some retreat times, who knows what would have happened. And we actually communicated with our children about it and said, you know, mommy will be a better mommy if she can get a little bit of time alone with God. And they knew it. And they remember to this day, they remember being told that at least, our older ones. So work with the people around you. And the other thing that's just really true and maybe a bit challenging is that if our solitude and silence is not helping us to be more loving people, then we might be not, we might be making it sort of a self-centered sort of thing. And so one of the things that I've tried to really be good about in my own life is to realize that I can set my best intentions for solitude, silence, retreat, or anything like that. But sometimes life intervenes
And, you know, a kid's been throwing up in the night, so I don't get my morning solitude. A friend goes into a crisis and I need to go and be there. That the whole purpose, you know, is to become more loving and available to God, you know, to be in God for others. And so we can let it go when life circumstances put that in our path and where that's part of the reality, knowing that we've set our intention deeply enough that the minute there's an opportunity to get back to it, we will. Yeah. And we know how to get there. Yeah. But when life interrupts, that the point of all of this is for Christ to be formed in us, you know, for the love of Christ to be formed in us. So if it's taking us away from the ability to be in love with others, then it's not working right. And so that's an important reminder, I think, for us, even in this practice.
That's really good.
I can't tell you how many times I've tried to cultivate that in the morning, and then my six-year-old wakes up before she's supposed to.
Oh, I know.
And I just get so angry. I'm like, go to bed. You know? Yeah.
It's like, what is wrong with this picture? Exactly. Why am I getting angry at my child when I'm, you know,
this sweet six,
when I'm trying to be so spiritual?
Yeah. And I'll never forget, God just one time was finally like, are you serious? Like, just invite her to pray with you. Yeah, and she loved it. And she's totally soaked it up. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, why did it take me months to figure that out?
I think you can see on people when they are balanced in their silence and solitude. Mm. There's like a peace that they have. I feel like that may be one of the reasons why we love grandmas so much. Yeah. You know, like, I went to a funeral last week of someone who was 102 years old. When they passed away, and they found her Bible, and just, I mean, they were showing it to us, like, just riddled in the margins with just names and circled scriptures, you know, oh, I pray for Hannah for this, or I pray for, you know, it was just like so obvious that she spent such a huge amount of time with God. When people look at silence and solitude, or when they hear about it, do you find that there is like a gut reaction, or like an immediate reaction, like maybe from things that they think it is? That maybe is a little bit scary. And what do you say to people like that? I mean, what do they tend to think of when they think silence and solitude?
Well, you're right that, I mean, silence and solitude is very scary, especially in our culture right now, where nobody's ever completely unplugged unless they've been really, really intentional about it. So I think that that silence and solitude are very challenging disciplines for a number of reasons. One is it challenges us psychologically because we're, you know, unplugging from the noise and the activities and the achievements that keep our sense of self shored up. And we have to face ourselves as we really are. We have to face what's real in our relationship with God for what it really is. We have to face what's empty. We have to face this fear of missing out. I mean, there's just so much that is challenging psychologically to silence, because we use our activities and our noise and everything else to distract us from the real true realities of what's going on in our souls. And we really, really cannot underestimate the challenge of solitude and silence. It's challenging to us culturally, because there's nothing in our culture that supports what we're talking about here. Everything in our culture supports being plugged in and overstimulated and distracted all the time. It challenges us relationally, because, you know, it's hard to withdraw from our relationships and to say to people, I love you and I need this time. I mean, people don't like it when we're not available to them. And now there's this way of being available to each other all the time. And so now, like, to say, I don't have my cell phone with me, I'm not available right now, is very challenging in relationships. And then finally, solitude and silence are challenging spiritually, I think, because I think the evil one knows how powerful it is to be in solitude and silence, to let God be God in our lives, to allow God to reestablish God's presence as the ultimate orienting reality of our lives. So be still and know that I am God is a very experiential type of a phrase. The be still means let go. Let go of your grip. Knowing is a much more than an intellectual knowing. It's that kind of knowing that the Old Testament talks about, where lovers know each other. A man knows his wife physically. You know, it's a very experiential sort of knowing, and that it's not about intellect. And I think the evil one knows that when we really know God in that way, experientially, and God becomes again the ultimate orienting reality of our lives, the evil one knows that his power in our lives will be diminished, that God will take God's rightful place and in our lives again through the practice of solitude and silence. And so I believe that the evil one brings every kind of distraction and every kind of obstacle to the practice of solitude and silence. And so there's even a spiritual battle going on, a spiritual warfare going on in moments when we're trying to enter into solitude and silence. So we really do need to take this invitation seriously, as the serious invitation that it is, and give people the help and support that they need versus dumping them into the deep end of the pool and allowing them to drown without any guidance, you know?
Yeah. You know, I love that you ground your book in the story of Elijah, you know, from 1 Kings 19. And what's so fascinating about that story is you see him come from quite literally a mountaintop, Mount Carmel, right? Where he has this epic moment of success and ministry, and everything seems like it's just like the greatest intimacy with God, right? And I kind of think that we've in evangelical world just become addicted to the Mount Carmel moments. We've allowed those to kind of be the thing that sustains our spiritual life. And I think that what's so beautiful about that story is it counterbalances with that moment where he's down in the valley, right? Because it doesn't discredit what happened on Mount Carmel. Like, there was a moment, an encounter of God that I can only imagine is deeply formative for Elijah, but yet he comes down off the mountain and he receives the one thread, and all of a sudden you see all that internal sediment just show, right? Like the jar is shaken, to use your metaphor, like, and all of a sudden it's muddy and he's like, I'm better off dead and this and that. I just wonder if, you know, I've kind of thought through that story as like, you know, Elijah found healing on the other side of distraction. And I'm just kind of even thinking through your own story. I think you mentioned you wrote this some 20 plus years ago. Like, what have you seen kind of in that tension of counterbalancing the mountaintops with the valleys? Like, how did those two experiences both interact with one another for your own formation? Like, talk a little bit about those. So I think, again, I feel like for our people, it's how do we counterbalance those really good, positive moments on the mountaintop with the moments of despair and kind of in that. So how have you seen those two play out over the 20 years since writing this particular book?
Well, it certainly does right size the mountaintop experiences, you know, because as grateful as I am for them, I also, you know, the way I present it in the book is to say that it wasn't completely fulfilling, because Elijah still needed something else.
Yeah.
Elijah still needed a private encounter with God. And it shows me that no matter what kind of successes we're experiencing publicly, that it also drains something from us. And we ought not to be unclear about that. That even when things are going really, really well, the power is still going out of us. And it's still draining on levels that we might not be able to perceive. And we need to be very, very, very careful about those times of success and making them the ultimate experiences of our lives, because they actually really aren't. And I have that experience a lot, where there's this experience of, God, thank you for doing this work through me, but it's not the same thing as me encountering you for myself. It's just not the same thing. And I'm grateful for how you meet me in my ministry life. And I'm grateful for the things that go well and the people who have been impacted in positive ways. But it still takes something from me that has to be replenished. And so to know that is really, really important, because it means that I can take care of myself then and make sure that I don't just go from one high to the next, to the next, to the next, and also get addicted to that. But that I let myself go to the different place where I say, God, that was really great. That was very nice. But I still need something from you that's more intimate and that it's more for me, and creating space for that versus getting addicted to the highs and the successes and all of that. I think for people in ministry, that's just absolutely essential.
Yeah.
One word that you kept bringing up, I think, was success. And in your book, you talked about both the definition of success and then the reimagined definition of productivity. I feel like both productivity and success are something that are huge for our culture, especially here in the Bay Area. So how do we enter into times of silence and solitude, not necessarily wanting to be productive in the way that we might understand it in a worldly way, but what does productivity and success look like for you, and how have you redefined those?
Well, one comes directly from Mother Teresa, where she talks about faithfulness. I think for me, for me now at this stage of my life, and for a long time now, I have defined success as being faithful, mm-hmm. which has much less to do with outcomes, and much more to do with just my own faithful response to God in every area of my life that I'm capable of bringing. So even doing something like publishing a book, which I'm in the middle of a launch season right now of a new book, even something like that, for me, I still experience it as faithfulness. Like I was just faithful to a topic that I know God wanted me to write. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad if it's received well, but what's more important to me is that I was faithful to do the thing that God asked me to do. And I did it to the best of my ability. And that means that whether it you know, rises or sinks, I'm not measuring it that way. I'm measuring it by whether or not I was faithful, and I was. Mm. That's a whole lot different than needing any external outcomes to define success for me, you know? And there's so much peace in that. There's just there can be such an equanimity in that, you know? It's significant. And so I think one of the things that solitude and silence actually do over time is to help us to be open and receptive, and then enter into our lives and our work and in our ministry in an open and receptive way, giving our best, but also trusting the outcomes to God. And solitude is a way to practice that, you know, it's a way that we can concretely practice not needing there to be certain external outcomes, but leaving outcomes to God. Mm-hmm. And there's no way that leaders today are going to be able to accomplish that without some sort of practice that helps them. It's not a concept. It's something you actually practice.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I found as someone who just, you know, more or less talks for a living, right? I'm preaching 40 times a year or so. Like, it is so difficult, but yet I as I've tried to cultivate this habit, it is the only space where the egos really starve, right? We're in it, and to do that intentionally. And in some ways, that unproductivity of it, if you will, is exactly what I need. I need to step into a space and say,
leaders need it more than anyone.
Yes.
The other thing that's so important for leaders is that solitude coupled with silence is it's a concrete way of giving up control for a little bit of time because you're not coming in with an agenda. And there's no way to measure the success of solitude and silence either. Because if you really do believe, as I do, that it happens at God's initiative, in God's way, and in God's time, and that whatever happens or doesn't happen is God's responsibility, then for a little tiny while, you are practicing giving up control and leaving all the outcomes to God. Yeah. So if nothing happens or something happens, it's not up to you.
Yeah.
If nothing happens and it was empty and it doesn't matter. That was what God did. Yeah. You know, you're not judging it, and you ought not to judge it, because it's up to God, and God knows. And so it's a way of practicing something that is hard for leaders, because most leaders are in control of every other aspect of their life, or at least they have the illusion of that, you know?
Yeah, I found that that's been the gift of Sabbath as well, is a day to say, like, the to-do list isn't finished and it's not going to be finished. I'm going to release control. And look, the world went on just fine without me. Like, lo and behold, I'm not as essential as I think I am, you know, in that. So anyway,
Ruth, you started off by saying you thought there was something wrong with you because you couldn't sit longer than, you know, what did you say, 10 minutes or something?
Well, it was 5. I couldn't even get to 10 in the beginning, which is really embarrassing.
You said everybody else is starting at 20.
It sounds so easy when she says it, you know?
But I'm just wondering, you know, we have potentially a lot of people that are trying to start this journey. Do you have any, like, and I know this is in your book, but I'm wondering if there's a few just off the top of your head, any practical tips as we get started? Maybe someone that's saying, you know, I'm going to dip my toe in this. I'm going to try. Is there anything practical that you could kind of send us to?
Well, let me mention maybe something that you can do from leadership, and then something that people can do practically in the moments where they're attempting. I think from a leadership standpoint, if you could give people some of their first experiences together, where maybe you sit in silence together for 10 minutes, that could be to be supported by your community and to not be alone. There's something really powerful about shared silence. Mm-hmm. So that is something that you could do from leadership. Maybe you already have. I don't know if you have.
We're planning that. We designed these things called practice labs, where it's more or less come try it on together. And the goal is for them to experience that, which by the way, I had a small group where I test drove kind of some of these things. And it was wild, the experience of starting in silence together, where it was like 5 minutes of the most awkward moments you've ever had. But then it grew, like the intimacy, where over time, that particular, it became easier in community actually than individually.
Absolutely. The community then holds, because you hold each other in the practice. And I think that that's really wonderful.
Yeah.
And even what you could do to mitigate some of the awkwardness is even do, I don't, maybe you have done this, but even do a short little reading, a short snippet of something that is about solitude and silence, and then go from there into the silence. So you're at least giving people a bit of a transition from the life in words that they've been living, using some little bit of writing to try to get people in. And then, so that's one thing. Then the other thing for the individuals themselves is, I think that the part of the book that offers that really concrete guidance, put your feet flat on the floor, open your hands on your lap, back straight so that you're alert in God's presence, pay attention to your breathing, set the timer, that drawing attention to those, that really practical way to do it. That's what was most helpful about my own spiritual director, is that she just helped me to just know what to literally do, you know? And then the whole idea of the, you know, it's, you could call it a breath prayer or whatever you want to call it, or the prayer phrase, to help, you know, to have people have a prayer phrase that brings them back to their original intention when the distractions come, really teaching them about distractions and what to do about distraction. And then the coming out with the Lord's Prayer. I think the Lord's Prayer is a lovely way to come, to move from that space of not being in words to being in words again. Is to let the Lord's Prayer be the words that bring you from your silence back into your life in the company of others. So those, that particular part of the book, I think, helps individuals in the moments when they're attempting this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
As someone who's really moves a lot, I have to take walks in order for me to really sometimes clear my head. I really resonated with in the book where you're talking about how to be in solitude. I don't necessarily have to sit quietly. And I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about that, how, like, in fact, you did these slow meditative walks, these jogs that slowly became a part of your practice.
Yeah. Yeah. I've done all those things. Yeah. I think that, you know, it's, there's a place for discernment in that also.
Okay.
Letting your body be still can also be pretty powerful, like letting your body lead and being still and letting your body have a rest. So that's rest for body, mind, and soul that I talk about, that even to give your body a rest and feel what it's like, you know, to your body to sit, to be comfortable, to stop moving so fast and to even let your body lead a little bit. And even to be curious about rest in your body. What does rest in your body mean to you? How do you experience that? So I would be discerning, you know, in that and really seek to understand what's most needed and what is most restful versus what might be a distraction or hyperactivity or whatever, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's so good.
I'd love to, you know, I'm thinking of Willard's Great Omission. He has that beautiful line where he says, you know, those distractions as they come, that your mind is doing what it's been trained to do. And so silence helps break that, that those are not the law of gravity and they can in fact change. And then he has that great line that I've always just been really intrigued by, where he says, you know, over time, your heart will continue to pull back to God, like the needle pulling back to north. And I'd love maybe if you could share just personally, thinking through again, 20 plus years of practicing silence and solitude, like, how have you felt it reshape the other dimensions of your life, you know, and how it's you've seen the effects in over again, such a long haul, like it's just, it's a gift to have someone where you have been doing this and it can almost put that vision out in front of us of like, look what maybe is possible. And I know that's a personal journey. And so it's not that it maps onto everyone's story, but I'd just be interested now looking back, how has such a commitment to this particular practice shaped the rest of your life?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I told you my early story in the book, and I still really love that moment where the kids were playing basketball outside and I was trying to write. Do you remember the story at the very end, for the sake of others? And, you know, where I was just so irritated that I couldn't get any quiet in order to write the thing, the spiritual thing I was trying to write. And that intercessory prayer stance that Julian of Norwich talks about, first I look at God, then I look at you, and then I look at God again, and how God, that was the moment when I began to transition from just being in solitude alone to seeing that solitude was going to make a difference in my life, in my real ordinary life with other people. And that I really cried out to God to help me to learn that I said, you know, God, if this is not making me better in my everyday ordinary life, it's just not worth it. It's just not worth anything. I don't know what it's worth if it doesn't make me be a better person in the life with the people that you've given to me. And that, in crying out to God at that moment, God actually taught me and guided me into that stance towards these teenagers who were playing basketball, and that it just changed my sight. In terms of how I saw them, it changed my heart. Yeah. It softened me. It opened me. Like, that was an extraordinary moment, like a truly extraordinary life-changing moment for me. And those kinds of things continue, you know. I'll just mention one thing that carries through to this very day. And that is that when we get more practiced at being with God, with what is, which is one of my favorite definitions of solitude, is that it's being with God, with what is. And as I get better and better at being open and receptive, just holding in God's presence, the great, you know, the great unfixables of life, sorrow, pain, grief, questions, whatever, and feel God's compassion for me and God's love for me in those places, it has changed how I am with people in those areas of their lives. You know, I think we pastor types, we really do like to fix people and think that we can fix people. And we want to have the silver bullet that they go back and they say, oh, I've talked to the pastor and the pastor said this and it changed my life. I mean, that's ego right there, isn't it? I mean, we just want to be that person. But we often violate people in that way as well. And one of the things that I know now is that oftentimes when we rush in with our own wisdom, we actually rob them of the chance of experience God coming to them in that place. And so now, as I've gotten more comfortable being quiet, you know, with silence with God, allowing God to care for me in that beyond words kind of a place, I'm much better at being with other people that way. And I think it ministers and means more than any words that I could ever throw at the situation. And it's changed that impetus or even that addiction to be the helper, you know, that I don't need it as much anymore. I mean, I can feel the impulse. I can feel the impulse to want to be that person that has the silver bullet that fixes their situation, but I can usually quiet it very easily now, knowing that's not really what's needed. So that's one thing. I think the other, you know, the other thing is the capacity, the increasing capacity for discernment that the practice of solitude and silence does enable us to start distinguishing the voice of God from all the other voices that clamor for our attention, and that we do become truly more discerning people, people who are in moments actually discerning what God is saying and where God is active versus always bringing our own human effort and striving in wisdom to situations. I am much more in tune always now with what's happening in the depths of my own being, but also what is God doing right here in this moment? Can I perceive it? Can I get on board with it? Can I participate with God versus bringing my own human striving and effort to every situation? So
that's good. Thank you for sharing that. I think that's, as a minister, that's a pastor, that's a really convicting point to work through. That's really, really good.
Well, Ruth, this has been so awesome, this conversation. We want to kind of wrap it up here, but I know that you've mentioned a little bit here, and you're writing a new book, or you've written a new book, Embracing Rhythms of Work and Rest. Is that right? Wondering if you want to tell us a little bit about, what we can expect, and a little teaser or.
Yeah, it's Embracing Rhythms of Work and Rest, from Sabbath to Sabbatical and Back Again. And I've written about Sabbath more briefly in a couple of other places. Sacred Rhythms has a chapter on it, and Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership has a chapter on Sabbath. But in this one, the impetus was because I had experienced sabbatical, and I really wanted to write a book about sabbatical because I think there are very, very few resources on sabbatical. But then the publisher said, well, that's very niched, so would you mind writing on Sabbath and sabbatical? And I said, well, I don't know if I have enough to say, but I'll try. And then, you know, what happened was that in the development of the book, I realized that I did have a new point of view that I wanted to bring, and it definitely has to do with our own personal practice of Sabbath, but even more importantly, experiencing Sabbath as a communal discipline. Mm-hmm. That it's really, really difficult to practice Sabbath when you don't have a community whose rhythms support it. And I think this is a desperate desire that especially the younger generation coming up has to join a community that would help them find a way of life that works, and specifically as it has to do with Sabbath. And really putting the impetus on the leader and the leadership team or group to lead a Sabbath community. I've sort of coined a new phrase in this one that casting a vision for not only the personal Sabbath practice, but for a Sabbath as a communal discipline led by leaders very intentionally. Yeah, and seeing the leadership of a Sabbath community being a very significant part of our own leadership, coming straight from Moses, you know, where God didn't give Joshua or Caleb or her or anybody else the you know, the instructions about Sabbath. I mean, it came down through the senior leader, and I'm feeling very, very convinced that this is a call of God on the lives of leaders these days, is to lead Sabbath communities, and just hoping to inspire leaders in their own practice, but not just by themselves. Cause I think that there's a lot of leaders that have their own personal practice of Sabbath, but they're not leading anybody else into it very well. That may not be true in your situation. I don't know your situation, but I do know that generally speaking, I don't know a lot of churches and communities that are actually ordering their lives around a Sabbath practice.
All right. We'll be one of the first.
We are
got the word.
We're going in the spring. That's the next kind of habit we're looking to develop. And I know it's been, my wife and I have been practicing Sabbath for like 6 years intentionally. And it's I hate to say life changing. That's such a cliche, but I don't know another phrase for it. Mm. It is utterly life changing for us. So timely. I'm excited to read that book and dig into it. I think I haven't thought that Sabbath community, that phrase, that's beautiful. And I'm excited to see kind of what could be in there on that. So
thank you for asking. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we want to honor your time, but we thought if you do have time, would you be able to close us in like a minute of silence?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Maybe Brandon can time us.
I'm timing us.
Okay. All right. Well, let me have my instructions and then then the minute, and then I'll come out.
Thank you.
I'll lead us out of it.
Okay.
So let's go ahead and do what we've discussed, and that is notice your body and notice how you're even sitting in the chair. Uncross your arms, uncross your legs, place your feet flat on the floor, straighten up your back as a way of saying to God in your body, I'm alert, I'm present, I'm not falling asleep. And you know, straightening up our backs actually feels very good when we've been sitting for a long time. So go ahead and feel the goodness of straightening up your back. If it feels comfortable to you, go ahead and open your hands on your lap or on your desk as a way of letting go of the cares and concerns that are with us right now, letting go of agenda, letting go of control, and also as a way of saying to God, I'm open and I'm receptive to receive whatever it is that you have to give me in this moment that we have. And then also breathe deeply as a way of coming in touch with the Spirit of God deep within. Recognize the Spirit who is closer to you than your breath. And maybe even on the inhale, breathe in the presence of Spirit. And on the exhale, breathe out the cares and concerns and the clinging and the grasping and the driving that all of us experience during our working days. And as we enter into this moment of silence, maybe there's a word that comes to you for this moment, something that expresses your heart's desire just right now. Love, presence, joy, openness, nearness. Just a word that expresses your desire right now. And allow that word to take you into this moment. And then if distractions come, just use the word to bring you back to your intention, and that is to be present with God right now. And then at 1 minute, I'll bring us out. So let's sit together. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as in heaven. Give us today our daily bread. Forgive us our sins, as we forgive those who sin against us. Save us from the time of trial, and deliver us from evil. For yours is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, now and forever. Amen.
Ruth, thank you so much, and God bless you for the work that you're doing.
And God bless your community as you take this journey together.
All right.
Thank you.
Oh, what a gift Ruth Haley Barton is to us. If you are unfamiliar with her work, I cannot recommend it enough. She mentioned a few just off the top of my head. Sacred Rhythms, so good. That's probably my favorite of hers. Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership is a beautiful book on leadership. Invitation Science and Solitude, which we'll be digging into a little more in the practice labs. And then I actually just picked up Invitation to Retreat. I don't know if you've read that.
It's on my Christmas list.
Is it? Okay.
Yes.
Nice. Yeah, it just came in the mail the other day. I was like, nice. Yeah, I read that. So, but man, like, just such a gift, the work she's doing and the experience she brings and who she is. I don't know. She just seemed to ooze kind of pastoral care, you know, on that. Yeah. So, I don't know. What were some of the things you guys were kind of sensing that stuck out to you guys or things you want to kick around a little bit or even questions you had kind of coming out of that?
I think one thing that stood out to me was the difference between the push-pull phenomenon and not being ready. Because in my mind, I found myself asking the question, well, what do you mean not ready? Because we talk about how like silence and solitude is accessible for anyone, in, regardless of where they are in their journey with the Lord. But then I guess there is a sense of maybe not being ready yet.
Yeah.
And what it looks like to enter into that, remembering that it's an invitation, not something forced.
Well, and I thought she brought up such a good point that I think my take from that was that maybe someone could not be ready if their desire isn't quite there yet. Like they have the belief in Jesus, which is awesome. And you guys can correct me if you disagree, of course, but like they've got the head knowledge. But maybe the desire to be close with him isn't it's just not there yet. And that's okay. I thought that's kind of what she was saying. Like this is a journey we're all on, and to view Jesus as, someone that I am closer to than breath. I'm like Ruth. I mean, I've been a Christian since I was 5, and I feel like, just in the last few years, for me personally, have I noticed that desire to just be alone with him really is the greatest desire of my life. But I don't know that I would have said that before, and I don't think there would have been anything wrong with me. Mm-hmm. I still knew Jesus. I just was maybe in a different spot.
Yeah.
If that's...
Yeah, well, it gets a little bit into the conversation that, you know, we talk about, like when we talked about Sabbath a while back. Now, this isn't an issue of like sin or not sin.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And I love the way she just kept reframing, like, it's not turning you more and more into a person of love and more and more into Christ-likeness.
So good.
It's not worth it, right? Like, it's not the point. The point is not to be silent and in solitude.
Mm.
The point's to grow in intimacy and in Christ-likeness and all those things. And I think that's spot on. Like, that's why it's invitation, right? Is the point is not the practice itself, but it means to that. Now, I think there are some points that she was kind of nuancing too, of like, I don't know quite how we grow in that intimacy without time with God. Like there is that kind of basic principle. Even again, in the same sense of if I'm going to, the door just like wiggled and slammed in the room we're in. Sorry, that was terrifying. But if I'm going to grow in intimacy with like Lindsay, you know, I mean, we're going to need time together.
Like, absolutely.
It's just fundamentally true.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's where there's a little bit of that nuance with this. But at the same time, I think, I love that balance she was saying. Don't force this if you're not ready. It's okay.
Yeah.
But maybe at times still push if it's just because of an uncomfortability to it. There's a tension you got to live in there, you know.
Such a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I do think silence and solitude in and of itself, like she said, is scary.
Yeah.
Potentially. So it's like, yeah, don't avoid it if it just feels awkward.
Yeah.
But if it's something that, yes, like for me, I so related the way when she said early in her chapter, and I think, or in, early in the book, and I think she said it today too, but just that she'd been a Christian for so long, but realized like she didn't really know how to love people well when it was hard or inconvenient. Mm. And I was just like, I remember reading that going, whoa, like that's me.
Yeah.
And so, but again, like not everyone maybe feels that not forcing, anything that's not true of us with God, I thought was another thing she kind of brought out of like, what is legitimately true of you right now with your relationship with God? Like start there.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't fix what ain't broke.
Yeah, you know what
I mean? Like, yeah, don't fix what I broke. But at the same time, like pushing past, because I think that's where, for someone who grew up in the church, who is full of information all over the place, but yet that doesn't always translate to formation. And I think that was part of where she was even talking about that moment of desperation. Is she almost realized like there's a plateau in her formation, which I know I've hit before.
Sure,
it's like, man, I can't necessarily study my way into a more tender heart for God, right? Like sometimes studying information goes along with it. And there are many times when I'm studying for a sermon or whatever it is where it almost doesn't break out like I'm praising God or whatnot, but it feels like worship because there's such a richness to it. And so I think it's that kind of balance of like, hey, if you're plateaued though, like try it on, you know, and if it doesn't work, discard it. And that's okay. Like again, the goal is not the practice itself, but what hopefully the practice can help produce.
Yes.
And bring about.
Yes.
I think it's not losing the forest for the trees.
It's back to the abiding, I think.
Yeah.
You know, we abide in Jesus and then we bear the fruit. You know, that's the goal. Well, I still think the goal is just being with Jesus, but the fruit is to produce good in the world.
Yeah.
I think
I think both are goals.
They're both.
I really do. I think I think God is, if we look at the grand arc of scripture, right? Like what is God doing? He's inviting and creating a new humanity who embodies and lives into the kingdom of God and the world around it for the sake of the world. And so I think that is a goal. I think, and it feels like if you attack it and think the goal only is that becomes problematic, because then you can leave Jesus and then it just becomes an own kind of pet project, this thing or whatever. And so you have to hold the language we're using, right? Presence and participation together. Both of those goals have to be interrelated. One without the other fails, right? Like pure only presence with God can almost create a sort of, how would I say it? Almost like a selfishness in our spirituality, right? But it is for the sake of others, which is the very tension Jesus was in. What's the greatest commandment? Love God and love others.
Neighbor.
He can't narrow it down to one. Mm-hmm. Like they are interrelated in some sense. So, but there is maybe an order.
Yes.
Kind of said where presence flows into participation.
Yes. So good.
Yeah. Sorry, Brandon, I cut you off.
No, it's okay. You said exactly what I was going to say.
Oh, man.